The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Robert Lustig. Robert is a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and a member of the Institute for Health Policy Studies at the University of California, San Francisco. He is also the chief science officer of Eat Real, a nonprofit dedicated to reversing childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. He wrote the New York Times bestselling book, Fat Chance, and his latest book is called The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. Robert Lustig, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Kelly. Really appreciate it.
So I had this email exchange with my wife when I was reading your book, and I actually wrote it down. It went something like this. I said, I'm really enjoying this book, but it's very hard not to self-analyze while I'm reading it. And she responded, is that a good thing? And I responded, it's cutting both ways. And my point is that you are doing, I think, two things in this book. You are alerting Americans to the fact that large forces are manipulating them for nefarious purposes, while you're also alerting Americans that they likely possess the ability to fight these forces, and they just don't know that.
Exactly right. Okay. Forces are, you know, under the radar, mm-hmm. and now, as of November 8th, over the radar. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, our minds have been hacked. Now, you ask me, you know, what do you mean by that? You know, there's no computer code up there. Well, there are ways to hack biologically. We've known about drugs forever, and that certainly hacks your brain. But turns out that it's more than that. It can be food. It can be our new technology environment. It can be sleep deprivation. There are many ways to alter our behavior, and industry has figured out how to do it, and they are altering it for their own purposes to basically get you to buy their products. It is called the American economy. And through the book, I basically lay out the empirical and the scientific evidence to prove it.
Yep. And you start with a very sort of basic idea here. And the quote that struck me early in the book was, quote, happiness is what most people say they want. And you go on to say, but despite over 500 years of our eyes on the prize, as a whole, we consistently miss the target. And that's where we're talking about, when you're talking about the difference between happiness and pleasure.
That's right. So let's define that, because that's really what the book is about.
Yeah.
Most people equate the two. They're both positive emotions. People think, well, you know, they both feel good. Why do I care? It actually matters a lot. And if you don't know the difference, you're basically doomed to have neither. So let's define what we mean by these two terms, pleasure and happiness. Number one, pleasure is short-lived, happiness is long-lived. Number two, pleasure is visceral, you feel it in your body. Happiness is ethereal, you feel it above the neck. Number three, pleasure is taking, happiness is giving. Mm. Number four, pleasure is achieved alone. Happiness is usually achieved in social groups. Number five, pleasure can be achieved with substances. Happiness cannot be achieved with substances. Number six, the extremes of pleasure, whether they be substances or behaviors, so substances like tobacco, alcohol, cocaine, heroin, sugar, and behaviors such as gambling, social media, internet, video games, porn, all at the extreme lead to addiction. Mm. But there's no such thing as being addicted to too much happiness. And then finally, the piece de resistance, number 7. Pleasure is dopamine, and happiness is serotonin. Mm-hmm. Now, you say, so what? Who cares? Well, in fact, you need to care. And it's because you don't care that you're unhappy. And the reason for this is totally scientific. Dopamine is an excitatory neurotransmitter, which means that when dopamine is released into the reward center of the brain, and there's a specific area in the brain that transduces all of those rewards, all 10 rewards that I just mentioned previously, all go into this one area known as the nucleus accumbens, the reward center, and it is mediated by this chemical dopamine. When dopamine binds to its receptor, a protein on the next cell that transduces that feeling, that cell is excited. Now, cells want to be excited. That's why they have receptors in the first place. But neurons are very fragile. They die easily. And neurons like to be tickled, not bludgeoned. So chronic overstimulation with an excitatory neurotransmitter leads to cell death. And you don't want your neurons to die. And your neurons don't want to die either. So they have a plan B. They have a self-defense mechanism. What they do is they downregulate the receptors, the number, so that the next time there are fewer receptors there to be able to transduce the signal, thereby protecting the cell from overstimulation. So in human terms, what does this mean? It means you get a hit, you get a rush, receptors go down. Next time you need a bigger hit to get the same rush, receptors go down, a bigger hit and a bigger hit and a bigger hit until finally you get a huge hit to get nothing. That's called tolerance. And then when the neurons actually start to die, that's called addiction. Serotonin, however, is not excitatory. It's inhibitory. And if you're inhibitory, you're not going to kill the cell. And so there's no downregulation of the serotonin receptor. So you can't overdose on too much happiness. But there is one thing that downregulates serotonin, dopamine. So the whole point of the book is the more pleasure you seek, the more unhappy you get.
This is
scientifically based.
It's fascinating, too, in the sense that there's a duality that's always at work here, and I find in many of our conversations, and on this podcast, we talk to all sorts of academics and scientists and CEOs and artists, craftsmen, different people, and it usually becomes that this epiphany that they have is that they always thought they were looking for one thing, and they were working with at least two things at any given time. And I love you have a sort of a line you have in the book which breaks it down in a kind of a story way that I think is really accessible, where you say pleasure is the straw that stirs the drink, happiness is the drink, anxiety melts the ice cubes. And it's great, right? So and that makes a lot of sense, which is like, and it's, I think of that old Buddhist metaphor of the finger pointing at the moon, and someone's like, you know, are you worshiping the moon or the finger? And I think that idea is that the pleasure is the finger, and the moon is really what you're sort of going for. And the thing that also gets in the way here is this idea of stress and anxiety. I'm, you know, from a sort of improvisational standpoint, one of the things, and there's very little science around this, it's starting to come, we're involved in some of it, and there's a few other kinds of studies around there, is the idea that when many people who suffer from social anxiety come into our improv classes, and many doctors have prescribed it, and we start our own class, because in essence, when you're improvising, you have to stay in the present moment, you're not worrying about before or after, and you're doing it in a group. So it is as opposed to sort of a one-on-one session, it's probably with like 6-7 people, so it's immensely pro-social. It's like pro-social meditation. And I kept, as I'm reading this book, I'm like, wow, the more I'm reading, the more I'm feeling like our stuff works as a practice towards not falling into these sort of pleasure habits or stress habits. And I'm sure you haven't given it this thought in terms of improvisation, but it just struck me that it was interesting.
No, it's actually, you make an extraordinarily good point, and I couldn't agree more. I'm sort of jumping the gun here, but, you know, the end of the book, the last part of the book, is about what you can do to try to fend off
right.
the corporate attacks that are being made on your nucleus accumbens. And I'll just mention them, that they're the four C's. And they're all things your mother taught you, but you forgot them. The first is connect. The second is contribute. The third is cope. And the fourth is cook. Hmm. Improvisation, in fact, is connection, contribution, and coping. three out of four.
Yeah.
And you know what? If you improvise your dinner tonight,
you're cooking.
The mole.
That's very – so let's jump into this too, because I had lunch today with my libertarian friend Tom, who is very pro-business. And I was talking about the book, and I started with all the stuff, and we're going to talk about sugar because that comes up over and over again. And he totally bought into what you were talking.
It's the thrills. It's the pleasure everyone can afford.
Oh man, you hate sugar.
Right.
This book is there's sugar on every page, and honestly, a lot of people are responding to it who I've talked about it. And I was worried about Tom because Tom's so pro business. And as I was explaining to him what you were talking about with regard to corporations and how they might play a part in it, I think I was able to articulate this in a way that sort of got through to him. And you say in the book, you go, corporations now have a legal right to interfere with your pursuit of happiness. And this is actually a rather deep argument because it's not just the sort of, you know, rulings of late that corporations are people, though you bring that up because that's
that was the ultimate.
Yeah, that's the ultimate. But there's other stuff at play.
Often Citizens mm-hmm. United, yes.
Yeah. So talk to us. Like, what are the other ways that you feel corporations are insidiously invading into our ability to be happy as individuals?
Well, by going for the dopamine surge, which, you know, gets you to purchase stuff, they are basically subverting your ability to obtain happiness, and they're doing it in insidious ways. We can talk about the corporate campaigns. You know, I love talking about that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing you have to understand is as your dopamine goes up, your serotonin goes down. And then throw a little stress on top. So cortisol, the stress hormone, there's an area of your brain that sits above your eyes, right, that, you know, behind your forehead, called the prefrontal cortex. It's the executive function mm-hmm. center. It's the part of your brain that keeps you from doing stupid things. Okay, it's your control center. It's, in the book, I liken it to Jiminy Cricket in Pinocchio, you know, basically telling, you know, you not to do the stupid thing. But cortisol inactivates that prefrontal cortex. And so what it does is it lets dopamine run rampant. And so if there's a behavior, you're much more likely to become addicted to it because there's no tamping it down. If it's a product or a substance, you're much more likely to overconsume it, which of course makes the company that makes it very happy. So, you know, the bottom line is these subliminal messages, and we talked about, you know, back in the 70s, everybody was into this subliminal messaging thing. Mm-hmm. They're not so subliminal anymore. Let's give you some examples, you know, so that people will understand what we're talking about. Let's take the obvious. Coca-Cola's Open Happiness. Mm-hmm. Okay? 10-year campaign, the longest advertising campaign by the company ever. Okay? Must have been because it was working. So the question is, any happiness in that bottle?
No.
Whole lot of pleasure, mm-hmm. you know, sugar and caffeine, reward center stimulators, direct, you know, and you can drink a whole lot of the stuff, and they put it in 20-ounce bottles to boot. So the question is, any happiness? In fact, it's the opposite, because though sugar, which we have shown it, is the primary contributor to this phenomenon called metabolic syndrome, which causes fatty liver disease, heart disease, hypertension, type 2 diabetes, and likely also because of the insulin resistance leads to cancer and dementia, and it very specifically depletes serotonin, mm-hmm. making you more unhappy. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's not really open happiness. It's more like open unhappiness.
Right, and the marketing too, with regard to this. So certainly, you have the sort of selling of happiness. You also have the opposite, where they're preying on your fear brain, right?
Absolutely. Okay, let's throw one in that does both.
Yeah.
Okay. Cialis. When
oh,
the time
yep.
comes, will you be ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you know, so let's add a little reward. You know, I mean, nothing like sex for a little reward, mm-hmm. and let's throw some stress in. You know, will you be ready?
Mm-hmm.
I even saw and it's in my PowerPoint slide set. I even saw a commercial for Cialis that's got one guy naked in the bathtub and two ladies on either side naked in bathtubs, and it says Cialis for three ways.
Oh, God.
And I'm going, like, are you kidding me?
Really?
You know, they know what they're doing.
And that's only running, I'm sure, in the San Francisco market.
I don't think so.
Oh, no. Well, so this made me think of something. One of our early podcasts was with a CEO, and he was an entrepreneur named Craig Dubitsky, and he was starting a new company called Hello Products. And the whole idea was he wanted to create non-fear-based dental products. And he went down the list of how we talk about dental products, and it's like as he's listing out these terrible adjectives, you know, it's all fear based, you know, attacking germs and all this stuff. He's like, you know, I don't want any of that, and I want soft colors, and I want to be, you know, positive, because indeed, fear is, I think you call it, a primary driver of consumption since the inception of marketing.
Indeed. Well, so that's the big issue here, and let's define it for the audience. Okay. This has to do with marketing, except it doesn't. Every company markets, or do they? So what's the definition of marketing? Using information to espouse your point of view.
Yeah.
Now give me the definition of propaganda.
Hmm.
Using disinformation to espouse your point of view. Well, so what's the difference between marketing and propaganda? The truth.
Right.
So when companies lie, they're propagandizing. And the fact of the matter is, they're all lying.
Yeah. There's a lot of that going around these days.
There sure is. And, you know, the fact is, sometimes we catch them in their lie. And, of course, tobacco, famously, you know, they're the ones, you know, where we actually had the, quote, smoking gun, unquote,
yeah.
You know, for real. But the fact of the matter is, we have it for, you know, several other products as well. We have it, actually, for sugar. And the reason we have it is because of my colleagues here at UCSF, Kristen Carnes, Laura Schmidt, and Stan Glantz, who actually unearthed the paper trail of a paper that was published, two papers that were published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1967, written by two scientists at the Harvard School of Public Health, the chairman of the Department of Nutrition, Fred Stair, and his assistant, Mark Hegstead, who became the head of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, when the dietary guidelines were adopted in 1977, mind you. And they were paid off $6,500 in those dollars then, which would be $50,000 today, to write those two review articles that exonerated sugar and fingered saturated fat as the bad guy.
Huh.
We now, after 50 years of painstaking research, have now demonstrated that saturated fat never was the bad guy. And sugar is a primary, if not the primary, cause of type 2 diabetes, fatty liver disease, heart disease, and tooth decay, and likely a contributor to cancer and dementia as well. These are things that were actually known back in 1967, but they were buried, and they were buried by the industry. So we actually have the smoking gun for sugar as well. This is propaganda. The point is, we've been propagandized. And what do you think propaganda does to your reward center?
Right.
They're playing on that reward center specifically to get a rise out of you.
Yeah.
So the fact of the matter is, they know what they're doing, and now they're doing it even better, because now they have something called neuromarketing, where they can actually read in real time the expressions on your face and alter the messaging in order to actually get in there based on how you are feeling. So they really do have control. So the question is, what are you going to do about it?
Right. And I want to actually have say a phrase from the book, because I think it also sums this up really nicely. You say, quote, "For heroin or cocaine, you need a dealer and a wad of cash. For alcohol or nicotine, you need an ID. But for sugar, all you need is a quarter or a grandma." And I grew up, my kid's grandma, I'm the youngest of six boys, and we had a cabinet full of cookies, full of candy, full of sugar-based cereals. I do not have a sweet tooth. And actually, most of my brothers don't either. And I don't know if that's a matter of ODing on it or just, you know, have the availability meant it wasn't exotic, which is kind of where I went, which is like it was so available. I wasn't interested in it. It wasn't alien or foreign to me. But I also had access to sort of self-regulation in a way that because of my privilege and where I grew up, that is completely different. But
so can I ask you a question?
Yeah, please.
Okay. You do improv.
Yeah.
Okay. And I am very, very admiring. I'm awestruck of people who can do improv. Do you know any people who do improv who are sugar addicts?
I know plenty of addicts. So as anyone who knows the history of Second City, I know a lot of addicts. And in fact, like one of the stories I've told before is you know, Chris Farley, who died so tragically, he was not just addicted to drugs. He was addicted to food. He was OCD. He went to church every day. I mean, it was across the board addictive personality. Yeah.
In fact, OCD is sort of the ultimate, you know, sort of expression of this. It's high dopamine, low serotonin.
Right.
In fact, in the book I describe, there's one particular emotion that most of us, if not all of us, have experienced at one time or another that actually turns you OCD. It's called love. Being in love, not so much, you know, the concept of love, but being in love is actually an OCD phenomenon. If you think about it, you do stupid things.
Yeah.
And you agonize over it, and you make yourself miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And dopamine is at, you know, mega, you know, it's going, you know, gangbusters in your nucleus accumbens, while serotonin is at very low ebb. And so there's an, you know, concept of, you know, how you can alter people's minds, you know, very easily.
Yeah, yeah. And this is an interesting part of the book as well, which is, the idea, and it's a solution point, right, which is the idea around connection. And you talk about two things. You talk about many things, but two that struck out to me. One is about this idea, and I know about the science, where that really shows that married couples live longer. It's scientific. There's data around that.
Yeah.
But also you talk about church. And this is something that comes up quite a bit on the podcast, because I certainly know that people in Chicago – Second City's been around for about 60 years, but really in the modern era, the last 10, 20 years, a lot of people use improvisation as a church substitute. And it's not a surprise that one of the busiest times for classes is Sunday during the day, and that there's all kinds of rites. And there's, you know, the call and response exists, right? Many of the same sort of triggers. So I'm curious, too, in reading for this is, I think you are less making a case for organized religion and more of making a case saying, hey, look, we lost a huge way that people connected to each other, and we need to find a way to get that back.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what I'm saying. It's not about the religion. It's about the community. Mm. You know, there are a lot of religions that work. You know, if there was only one religion that worked, everybody would be the same religion. You know, they all work. Okay, it's kind of like cold medicines. You know, the point is that the reason for religions working is not necessarily the message of the religion per se, since many religions have different messages. But it's the sense of community, the fact that you're not alone, the fact that you greet people face to face, eye to eye. Okay, in a common venue. In fact, you have a set of neurons in your brain called mirror neurons. And these neurons are reading the person you're talking to's expressions on the fly, exactly like the neuromarketers are reading yours.
Hmm.
You're doing that with the person you're talking to. And what happens is those mirror neurons help you adopt some of the same feelings and emotions that you are reading in that other person's face. I'm sure you know that virtually every society on the planet have the exact same facial expressions for the same emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like they learn them from each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is, you know, baked into our DNA is why this is. And so our mirror neurons are reading these. And what that does is it generates serotonin. And that's the process that we commonly call empathy. And if you don't have empathy, you can't have happiness.
I'm curious, too, when you think about communities, about religious structures and that. You have a set of checks and balances that exists that I certainly get that with being, you know, I've been married for 20 years, 21 years, and I know that if I weren't married, things would have gone not well. But another aspect that I found interesting.
By the way, I'm at 22 and a half.
Oh, there you go. Dacre Keltner at UC Berkeley, who's written about power, talked about the positive effects of gossip. And he basically said gossip is used often to keep the powerful in check. And I think about, you know, one of the things that I didn't enjoy about growing up Catholic in the Catholic Church here was how gossipy I felt it was. But now in retrospect, I'm like, you know what? There was an element of that, now that I look back, that was not wrong-headed at all. So I think there are these weird things that when you frame them in a certain way, you certainly can understand them as negatives. But then there's this other aspect that maybe they were pro-social in a way that we didn't understand.
Or maybe they were trying to exert an external prefrontal cortex on people.
Is that is that another way
of doing stupid things?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess I mean probably right. You mean that's
maybe.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay, another thing I wanted to ask you about, because I'm also trying to figure out sometimes things like, I wonder what this person's politics are, because you're so all over the map and very hard to sort of put into one area.
Well, that's because I'm very hard to put in
one area. So I want to ask you about Obamacare and kind of perfect timing. So literally like what, 20 minutes before we got on the phone, Tom Price just resigned from.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well done. Well done. All right.
After all those flights.
Up for that.
And we all have our opinions on healthcare, and there's so much to unpack in terms of what's happening right now, I think especially from a scientific level. But you brought up, and I'm left. Of course, I'm Chicago. I'm theater. We know where I stand. But you brought up, I think, a really compelling reason why Obamacare, in many ways, would never work. With regard to it not focused on preventative medicine.
Right. So, look, I'm a pediatrician. I went into it to help people, help children. Okay. And let me tell you, if you're a pediatrician, you are not in it for the money.
Okay,
because there are a whole lot easier ways to make a couple of bucks than this.
Yeah,
promise. Mm-hmm. All right. So I do it for the happiness. You know, for the feeling of self commitment. You know, for the achievement, for the contribution portion of it. All right. However, Obamacare is a problem, and here's the reason. What people don't understand. President Obama told us that we could put 32 million sick people onto the rolls by providing preventative services that they wouldn't have to go to the emergency room. They would be able to see their own doctor, and they'd be able to get medicines before they got sick. And by staying out of the ER, we could basically, you know, give them care that would cost 50 times less or 100 times less than what the emergency room does. And that would ultimately pay for itself. Sounds good, at least in theory.
Yeah.
The problem is there is no medicalized prevention of chronic metabolic disease. Doesn't exist. There is a way, but it's not medicalized. So, in fact, after Obamacare was instituted, emergency room visits went up, and they're continuing to go up. Mm-hmm. And so much so that three of the major insurers, United, Aetna, and Humana, have opted out of the Obamacare exchanges because they can't make any money because the emergency rooms are cluttered.
Hmm.
And they're paying off those bills.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't work. And the reason is because that's a false precept. There's a second false precept, too. You can't fix health care until you fix health. And you can't fix health until you fix diet. And you can't fix diet until you know what the problem is. Well, we've been working off the wrong precept for the last 50 years for the reasons we just talked about.
Yeah.
And I'm doing my utmost, based on the science, to promulgate and advance the new nutrition, which basically takes the entire food pyramid and turns it on its head.
Hmm.
Because we got it wrong, and we were basically hacked to do
right.
So.
Right.
rather than a processed food diet, we have determined that we could save about, and you know, this is a back of envelope calculation, we could probably save about 50% of healthcare costs. And that would allow everyone to have healthcare, and it would also allow us to have a balanced budget to boot. So, you know, this is not a little thing. This is a very big thing. Problem is, not like Trump care, it's off the table now, which, thank God, but right. if Trump was going to, you know, advance a healthcare agenda, he wouldn't be any more successful because there's nothing about diet there either. You know, the Obamacare bill, the ACA bill, was 1,096 pages, and not once was the word diet mentioned. This is a problem.
Is there, thinking back to my behavioral scientist friends, and recognizing that these are behaviors, is there a nudge solution? You know, in the way that, you know, so Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein have talked about, you know, what they've done with regard to, you know, opting in or opting out, and you just change that. Is there something like that that could exist in communities as regards to diet?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've been trying to advance exactly that. I agree. You know, here's the thing, okay? You can't tell people what to do.
Right.
You know, I say in the book, you know, I'm a New Yorker, okay? If you tell me to jump, okay, my first two words to you are not how far, okay?
Right. I bet I know what two words they are.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. family show.
Yeah, it's not, by the way, but yes, that's fine.
The point is that you can't tell people what to do. However, you can nudge them into doing the right thing by incentivizing and punishing at the same time. You can't do it with a carrot. You can't do it with a stick. What you need is a carrot and a stick together,
yep,
and have them yoked,
yep,
to each other.
Yep.
Let me give you an example of how it works. In 1977, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, huge problem with alcoholism. Okay, on both sides of the ledger, people were calling in on Monday morning on their benders from over-drinking the entire weekend before, you know, because after all, it's dank and it's dark and it's cold and, yep, you know, there was nothing to do except drink. And cirrhosis of the liver and car accidents were eating up the negative side of the ledger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, big problem, all three countries. They banded together and they passed two pieces of legislation. First, they nationalized the liquor stores so that every liquor store sold the exact same fare at the exact same price. So you couldn't go somewhere else and buy it cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And second, they subsidized low-alcohol beer, and they taxed high-alcohol spirits. And they used the money from the tax of the spirits to pay for the subsidy,
mm-hmm,
yoked together.
Mm-hmm.
It was a zero-sum game in terms of money, but what it did was it nudged people into consuming more low-alcohol beer,
hmm,
rather than high-alcohol spirits. And sure enough, over the next 20 years, productivity, economic productivity, went up in each country, and car accidents and cirrhosis of the liver went down. Okay, and we are now 40 years after that, and both of those are still in place.
Wow.
Because they work.
Yeah.
And nobody feels deprived.
Right.
A public health win, and no one feels deprived because we had the carrot and the stick tied together. So how could you do that, say, with diet today? Okay. Well, in Chicago there, you have a soda tax, don't you?
Yeah.
Why don't you take the money that the tax raises and subsidize water?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, carrot and stick.
Yep.
Okay, and they'd be yoked together. And you know what? The beverage industry would be delighted. You know why? Because they make the water, too.
Sure.
Okay?
Sure.
You've got to drink, okay? You can't not drink.
Yeah, yeah, product is still needed.
They don't care what they sell,
yeah, as long,
as they sell.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? All right? And this would be a, you know, something that could be done across the board in virtually any community in any state. Really, it could be done nationally. You know, so I'm not for taxation. I'm not for subsidization. I'm for what is called differential subsidization.
Mm-hmm.
Carrot and stick yoked together. That would be a perfect example of how you could have a public health win and save money at the same time.
Yeah, and it doesn't it the other thing, it's interesting, we talk a lot about loss aversion, right? That people really respond poorly to having something taken away from them, even more so than having something given to them. And you have qualified that because if you are doing a bit of taking away, there's also a give. So it doesn't, you're not going to go to the extreme. I love that. It speaks to that earlier other idea that, you know, this there's always two things in play. And we're always looking for one big solution, and that's just not out there.
I also tell you that, you know, different communities will probably have different solutions.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, I mean, look, blue laws, you know, prevented alcohol consumption in certain neighborhoods. You know, I've suggested blue laws at, you know, schools between 7 and 9 a.m. and 3 and 5 p.m., you know, so that kids can't go to the convenience store on the way to school and get the Coca-Cola.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, ultimately, we have to do something. You cannot have a problem with a hedonic substance and expect that education is going to solve the problem. Did Nancy Reagan's Just Say No work?
Not at all.
We now have an opioid crisis.
Yeah.
Right? The fact of the matter is, hedonic substances are hedonic. That means that you can know that that thing, whatever it is, whether it's a behavior or a substance, is ruining your life, ruining your family, ruining your economics, and you can't do a damn thing about it because of the biochemistry.
Hmm.
So we need to have public health efforts that are directed toward helping us nudge ourselves in the right direction. And they can be done. They can be rational. They can be approached. But you have to put it on the table. You know, the libertarians say, you know, don't, you know, keep government out of my kitchen. Well, you know, I don't want government in my kitchen either. But to be honest with you, which would you rather have in your kitchen? The government who will take your wallet and your freedom? Or would you rather have the food industry who will take your wallet, your freedom, and your health?
Right. Someone's already in your kitchen. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know.
Someone's already there. Mm-hmm. You're too late.
Yep, yep.
And where were you during those 40 years? Did you stop them then?
Right.
So, you know, there's a real problem here. You know, there's a lot of double talk here.
All of this is fascinating. And we're coming to the end of our time together. And one of the things that we ask every guest, and I'm actually very curious on your end about this, is do you have a yes and story? Do you have a time in your life, whether it's related to your work or, you know, it could be something else, where you would have said no, but instead you took a chance and you didn't just stop at yes, you said yes and?
I guess when I decided to go into academic medicine, I was under a lot of financial debt. I was under a lot of pressure by, you know, family members to go into private practice.
Mm-hmm.
My mother always told me she wanted her condo on the French Riviera. And I basically said, you know, that I was going to try academic medicine, and if I was unsuccessful, I would do exactly what she wanted.
Huh.
Well, I was unsuccessful probably for a good 2 decades. And then in 2006, because of the work that I had done, I got a phone call from the White House Office of Presidential Appointments asking me if I would be interested in being considered for Surgeon General.
Wow.
And my mother never questioned my choice again.
What was that? So what was that like with the, in terms of the process? So you got vetted?
There was no process.
Okay.
The fact is, George W. Bush decided the next Surgeon General was going to have to tackle childhood obesity.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, they changed their minds somewhere along the way, and they nominated this guy from Kentucky who had basically said that homosexuality was an offense against God.
Right.
Penile cancer was the manifestation of that.
Mm-hmm.
He never got confirmed.
Right.
And so we actually had an interim Surgeon General for the rest of the Bush administration.
I just met our last Surgeon General at the Aspen Ideas Festival in the Spotlight Health section.
Vivek Murthy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the top flight guy, really, really smart,
yep.
In it for all the right reasons.
Exactly, yeah, and not there now.
Right.
And it was and it was fascinating. And we found ourselves at Aspen because we created a program with a group called Caring Across Generations to bring improvisation to caregivers, both as a way for them to use improv practices to tease out stories and be others focused for the person who's in front of them and be present and sort of say yes and instead of blocking, but also to use improvisation as a way to find agency in themselves. And we did a presentation, and I was so out of my depth because I'm not a medically inclined person. It's not my field. But man, oh man, we went to so many incredible seminars and kept getting into interesting conversations with people across a variety of different areas. And this is the thing that kept coming up, which is we're doing it wrong. That it's not just that this policy is not the right policy, or it's not Democrats or Republicans. Like, we're all doing it wrong, and our eye is not on the right ball. And across the board, it was sort of like, we need to not be worrying so much about the hospitals. We got to be worrying about getting the people so they don't have to go to the hospitals. We've got to look at for elder care, creating communities outside of the hospitals where people can take care of each other. And it was this. Such a clear message.
It's not about health care.
Yeah.
It's about health.
Yes, not about health care. It's about health.
We spend more on health care and have the worst health around.
Yep, yep. And they kept saying it's backwards, right? The amount we spend preventative, it just needs to be flipped. That's all we need to do, which is what everyone else does who has a successful...
People understood the difference between pleasure and happiness, they would flip. That's the reason I wrote the book.
Well, we will work on that, and part of it is getting out this podcast. Robert Lustig, thank you for joining me on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down, working in a coal mine, going down, working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down, 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm up before the sun, when my work day is over, too tired for having fun, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down, working in a coal mine, going down, working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
Lord, I am so tired. How long can this go on?
Well, I've been working.
Working.